Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love, and you are listening to a special recording of Vodka O'Clock. This was recorded live at the New York Special Edition Comic-Con held by Reed Pop. You know them as the people who put on the really large October New York Comic-Con. And so the Special Edition show is a comics-centric show. It's basically if you took the Artist's Alley from the massive October show and put it in its show all of its own. And this year they actually had a lot more cosplay than I noticed. But anyway, the show did seem to stay really comic focused. And this particular panel was about creating comics and some of the things that you need to think about when you make comics, like contracts and how you get paid and how much money people make and or don't make, and you know, in a utopia they would make. So if you check out the show notes, I've got some images of what the panelists did for breaking down where they thought the pay scale should be for each particular task of making comics. I don't think they had editing listed, but a lot of other things were listed there. So take a look at the show notes at amberunmasked.com. And don't forget that if you like the coverage and content of the website, you can go to patreon.com/amberunmasked, and you can sponsor everything for as little as $1 per week. So on this panel was Chris Sotomayor, Vera Green Tea, Ulysses Farinas, Joseph Ilyich, Fernando Ruiz, and Alex DeCampi. And don't forget, there will be more special edition coverage to come. Stay tuned at amberunmasked.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Let's Talk About Checks. There's a lot of noise around, so if we can't hear you, like, wave at us. Or if you can't hear us, wave at us. We all need to talk loud. Clever sound divider between these two panels, which does not divide sound at all. We're still waiting for a couple of our panelists. I think there's a bathroom issue, and there's like one working bathroom in this entire barn. And Fernando is probably using it. And Joe's in the taxi on his way here. But we have so much to tell you, we thought we'd start now. And I'm going to start off with introducing the people we do have. And what I'm going to ask you to do when your slide comes up is say who you are and what you do in comics, and then tell us what your first pro comics gig was, like when someone paid you money to do some part of a comic, and how you got that gig. Because, you know, it's all, there'll be a common thread which we shall reveal later. I'm Alex, I write comics, more about me later. Bye. Thank you all for coming, there are a lot of you, it's my first comic panel moderating, and I'm only mildly terrified. Okay, Ulysses.
Hi, I'm Ulysses Farinas. The last book I worked on was Judge Dredd, Mega City 2 with Douglas Wolf. Currently working on this comic called Amazing Forest and this other comic called Gamma. The first gig I got was Transformers, Heart of Darkness for IDW. Do you want the page rates too?
Oh yeah, you can tell rates if you want.
Do I do how I got it?
Yeah, let's do how I got it.
I got it. The first time I got it was a little weird. I actually went to a Google cache page for IDW and found an old email address for a submission email, because they actually took down their submission email address. And I emailed that address, and the editor from Transformers, Bobby Kernel, he actually wrote me back. And he was like, yeah, would you want to work on it? And I was like, yes. And I didn't expect anyone to actually reply from this defunct email address, but it must have still been up, just the website itself, the page itself was taken down. That's how I got my first gig.
Okay, cross down traffic.
Everyone, thanks for coming. Sorry for being late. I'm actually going to work this into our panel. Trust me, this is going to be relevant.
Next, Vera Green Tea.
Hello.
Beard Nancy, and I self-publish my comics. I've been self-publishing for about 4 years right now, and I just got my first pro gig with Dark Horse Creepy Comics. My comic is coming out in August 5th. Order it. How I got it? Actually, I got it through Alex. I was sharing the booth at New York Comic Con with Alex. Her editor came to hang out with her, and when I left, I came back and I saw this dude sitting in my chair, and I was like, "Who are you?" And turned out he was an editor of Peepee, and he was looking through my stuff, and he said, "Do you want to pitch something?" And I said, "Yeah." So, and that's how I got my first gig.
And if all of you have self-publishing questions, Vera has done like multiple successful Kickstarters. You know, coming from no background in the industry, she's published Papa and then 2 miniseries?
Yes.
And like doing Kickstarters for each individual issue. So how many successful Kickstarters have you done?
8.
Wow. So she knows a bit. And only now is she starting to get paid work in comics, like other than, you know, that tall comics dollar you earned from Kickstarter, that profit that's like keeping you in, you know, the Upper East Side in your Lamborghini.
Yeah.
Okay. Joseph P. Illich.
Hello, hello. Wow, so we tell our bios first and then I can take my laser off and we can get into it? How does it work?
Well, just say what you do in comics and tell people how you got your first pro gig in comics, like the first time you were paid to do something in comics.
Wow. Okay. My name is Joseph Village. I'm a writer and editor in comics. My career started at Milestone, which was the first black-owned comic book company to have a publishing deal with DC Comics. And then from there, I went to DC Comics, and I was an editor of the Batman line of books during Batman No Man's Land and the 2000 relaunch. And then after that, I went to Archaea. Archaea was a creator-owned comic book company. They're most well known for Mouse Guard, and Archaea is now a division of Boom. And I am now writing a Harlem Renaissance graphic novel for First Second Books, and I am a freelance editor. And the way I got my first professional gig was I started at the bottom, and I was an intern at Milestone, and I was there for 3 months, and I did all the grunt work. But while doing the grunt work, I learned how a comic book business worked, not only on the creative side, but on the business side. So after 3 months, I said, hey, you know what? This has been fun. I really dig it, but I have to go get a paying job. And they offered me a job. And that was my first gig in comic books. And we'll talk a lot more about things like that as we go along.
That's the first important lesson of comics. This industry does not give you anything unless you ask for it. Ask for money.
Well, for me, it all started at the Kubrick School. I enrolled in the Kubrick School. I was there for three years. It's a three-year program. One of the great things about the school is they invite all the different comic book companies to the school to go over the graduating students' portfolios. So Marvel, DC, if they don't come to the school, then the school takes the students to them on field trips and things. So one of the companies that came the year I was graduating was Archie Comics. So I was very fortunate that Archie's editor-in-chief, Victor Gorelick, and the legendary Dan DiCarlo, drew Archie for like 50 years. They both came, they looked at my portfolio, and they liked what I could do. So I was very fortunate in that very day, Victor offered me my first story. So I was able to graduate, and a week after I graduated, I went to the Archie offices for the first time, and they gave me my first script, which was kind of a short little 5-page Archie story, which appeared in Archie's Pals and Gals Double Digest number 8.
Chris?
Hi, my name is Christopher Sotomayor, and I'm a freelance colorist with Marvel, DC, Legendary, pretty much everywhere, because it's freelance and that's what you do. I also run an illustration studio that dabbles in packaging boutique artwork for toy companies, game companies, storybooks, other corporate comics, things like that. I'm going to do my story a little memento style, because it's a lot of comics, and getting into comics is about connections and, you know, common threads, as Alex I'm sure we'll touch on later. My first paid freelance gig was with Disney Adventures Magazine, which I had gotten from connections that I made while I was an editor at a smaller publisher that had done a publishing deal with Image Comics, which I had gotten from an apprenticeship with a former Milestone founder, Michael Davis, where I interned in his studio for, I don't know, about 3 or 4 years before I actually got my editorial position in 1994. Through that apprenticeship program, I met not just other upcoming artists like John Paul Leon, Bernard Chang, Sean Martinborough, those guys and a bunch of others, but I was also afforded the opportunity to meet with and speak with guys like Dennis Callen, Walt Simonson, Dwayne McDuffie, and a bunch of guys who not just helped start Milestone, which was very important at the time. And I think still is very important now. Its legacy is immeasurable. But that all started even from an introduction. I kind of stalked an artist, a comic book artist named Dennis Callen, from when I went to art school at SBA here in New York. And he introduced me to Michael Davis, who gave me the position in his studio, the apprenticeship in his studio, and like I said, that got me the editorial position in 1994. And then from there, in 1996, I started my freelance career.
I think one of the common threads I wanted to pull out, like, although Ulysses is the only person who's got his first gig by a cold calling, because Ulysses is special, and an amazing artist. I'm Alex, I write comics. My first pro gig was, IDW took my book Smoke in 2005. I sold that book. I started writing comics because I hung out in bars in London, and I had a bunch of friends who wrote comics who also hung out in the same bars. And I'd read comics as a kid. I grew up on Claremont's X-Men. I went to San Diego, and they, by friends who were writing for IDW, introduced me to Chris Ryle. And also a couple of other publishers, so I could hand over my pitch. And Chris gave us the best deal, and that was my first paid comics gig. I personally have never gotten a single ounce of comics work via cold mailing. It's always by a friend of a friend, or a recommendation, or, oh, can you introduce me too? What about you guys? Like, how much have you gotten via just people you don't know versus via chains of connections?
No. I may get an opportunity through a friend, because what happened was, after I left Milestone, I actually was a temp assistant editor in the Green Lantern office. So I worked on the Green Lantern books, I worked on the Tangent books, and what happened was, after a few months of doing that, I went to Simon & Schuster and I worked in the Star Trek division, and what happened was, a spot appeared in the Batman office. And because of the good work that I did when I worked with the Green Lantern and Tangent people, they offered me a job. So even though getting the temp gig was through a recommendation, and that recommendation wouldn't have flown if I didn't do good work at Milestone, the work that I did as a temp got me the Batman gig. So one relationship did get me in, but that relationship was able to use the foundation of my work ethic. And I think that's really the most important thing. I realize now a lot of people say it's all about who you know and this and that, but someone who's gonna recommend you is putting their neck on a chopping block. So if they recommend you in a strange way, you have an obligation to make them look good.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I mean, you have to be good. Like, the baseline is you have to be good. But the point I'd like to suggest about the fact that so much of this business, so many, like, people will open doors for you. It's up to you to walk through the door and be good enough to be well received once you go through that door. The point about connections is that, okay, so this business happens a lot on connections. So a comic book comes out that you think, like, is terrible and you could do it so much better. What do? Do you email the editor who edited that book and say, oh, this writer's terrible, I could do so much better. Oh, this artist doesn't know what I mean. Do you do that? Do you tweet about how rubbish the new, like, mainstream X book is, and how doing so much better. You know, so you know, because these are chains of friendship, you have to, you know, it's totally fine to rip apart comic books. We do that all the time. Indirect message conversations and at bars in real life. Like, friends of mine and I will come like to a bar with a stack of comics and we'll just go through them and say exactly what we think. That is the place to do it. You know, I'm not saying don't express yourself. I'm saying don't insult potential future employers.
It's a very small industry out there.
And it's really easy to check someone's Twitter feed or Facebook feed, you know. You think you're being clever, but you'd be amazed. So some of the stuff we're going to talk about is going to seem like pretty rich stuff to you guys, because a lot of people, this is Maslow's hierarchy. I've done a comics version of it. You know, most of us, when you're just starting out, you just want to get published. You're on that bottom line. You don't care if you get paid. You just want, like, to get your comic out there. But we're going to really start off talking about some of the higher level stuff, like what is a good contract and what is a living wage, because we realize that in the beginning, you know, if it's a bad deal or no deal, pretty much anyone's going to sign the bad deal because it gets you in and it gets you something printed that you can then hand to other people to get the good deal. But we just want you to keep in mind as you progress through the industry, and I hope you all do, that you should know what you're aiming towards and know what a good contract is, what a good wage is, you know, what you're worth. Knowledge is power, and there's a saying like, oh, we don't talk about money. That was a saying started by basically capital to keep labor enthralled to it. You know, from an old socialist perspective, the people who don't want you to talk about money are the people who have a lot of money. So when you compare notes and find out that, like, oh, so-and-so is being paid twice what you are, you know, then you can work and organize, or at least go and say, hey, you know, my next book with you, I'd like $100 as a page rate. And they go, oh, really? And you go, oh, well, yeah, you know, that's the rate. You know, or you can realize how good a deal you're being offered in the relative scheme of things. And I know some of you will probably be like, oh, but I am an artist that just wells forth from inside me, and I have to produce, and I don't even care if I get paid. Do you know who started that particular line of bullshit? That was Lord Byron. Is there any clue in his name about how much money he has and how much he needed money? Lord Byron? He did, like, of course he could sit there and, like, well up and, like, write poetry all day. Like, he was rich. So, you know, unless you're a lord, keep your eye on the prize. Like, you have to be in this for the long term. You have to be paid what you're worth, and you have to keep control of the things that are yours and not give them up without knowing you're giving them up. So first we're going to talk about the top of Maslow's hierarchy, which is contracts. You know, again, when you start out, you're pretty much going to take any contract that you're offered because you're getting a contract, whee! But there are things you should watch out for. The caveat is we are not lawyers. You're a lawyer, are you?
No lawyers.
We are people who have signed a lot of contracts, good and bad. And I'd say, you know, everyone signs at least two bad deals in this business. You sign two bad contracts. If you sign more than that, it's up to you. But nobody's perfect. I've taken the bad deal. My bad deal was Tokyo Pop. I signed that contract twice. I now don't own those properties, and they're kind of stuck forever in limbo. I don't regret signing that contract, but I would not do it again. I'm going to quickly go over some areas to watch in contracts, and then I thought we could all share some of our experiences about contracts and collaboration and stuff. It is the three R's: rights, royalties, and reversions. Rights. What is the publisher taking? They generally take all the publishing rights. That's fine. They're publishing the book. They should have publishing rights. The two areas you need to look at and watch like a hawk for are secondary rights, film, TV, merchandising, whatever. And also foreign publication rights. Who has those? Like if a German publisher wants to publish a deluxe version of your comic, who has the right to negotiate that deal? Is it your publisher or is it you? And you might think, I don't know anything about negotiating deals or like doing Hollywood, so it's much better if the publisher does that. Possibly not. Sometimes the publishers don't do anything about the foreign rights, and then you kind of say, hey, I'm a little bigger in the industry now, I have an agent, he can handle that, can I have them back? The publisher's like, no, you signed a contract. That's the thing about contracts. They're not for the good times. They're for the bad times. They're protecting you in the bad times when the guy you knew and who's your best friend at the company left. You're a lot bigger and you want the property back. The secondary rights thing, you think, oh, it's so nice that they can take care of something for Hollywood for me, and they have a production company, and that's wonderful, and that production company has a first look deal with Universal or whatever. The difficulty with that is it begins a game of inside baseball. The publisher comes to you and says, hey, our own production company wants to do an option on this. They're going to pay you $5,000 up front. Oh my God, you're getting $5,000 for your idea. That's like big Hollywood money. Woo! Yeah. $5,000 and $25,000 if it's made into a movie, which, you know, frequently doesn't happen. That's not a fair rate. That's them, you know, that's the production company getting a cheap option on a property co-owned by the actual publishing company that's like part of them. And what they're essentially doing is getting like cheap to free IP, because like the usual upfront for an option is $25,000 to $100,000. So you get your measly $1,000, you get your measly $5,000, you're on Twitter, go, I got an option. Well, congratulations, you also just got ripped off. So that's why it's a good idea to keep all of your film rights. Do not give them to people, especially people who already have an associated company that they're going to try to shift them towards. Royalties. This is a big thing for work-for-hire contracts. Some work-for-hire contracts, you just get a check. You write your script, you do your art, you get a check, done. That's it. That's all you'll ever see. And then you start seeing, like, lovely hardback versions of the book come out, and the trade paperback, and then they republish it, and it becomes really popular. You're never going to see any more money from it. That's it. You've got your check. Royalties are what keep you alive when no rain falls in your career. You know, when you are, like, when no one wants to know you, and that happens to everybody. You have a couple of years where no one wants to know you, you're not trendy, you had a book that bombed, doesn't matter. The royalties that keep coming through from your other books are those like little $300, $500, $1,000 little bits of joy that keep you alive. And also, like, so always make sure you get royalties and look askance, unless you've got to pay your rent. Try not to take contracts, work for hire contracts that don't pay you a royalty. You know, it's essentially, like, if your book becomes Dark Knight, you know, you want to be paid every time that thing gets sold. If it's Watchmen, you want to keep seeing that money coming in. And speaking of Watchmen, my last point on contracts, reversions, aka the Alan Moore clause. Alan Moore no longer owns Watchmen because his deal with Vertigo was, DC at the time, was DC would have the rights to the book as long as it was still in print. Well, lots of Alan's British work had gone out of print fairly quickly. You know, British publishing was fairly small. So he signs a deal thinking, yeah, we'll get it back in a couple of years when everyone stops buying Watchmen. Well, DC realized it was an important book and it never stopped being out of print. When does your work come back to you? How do you protect yourself if the comic book company goes bankrupt, which a lot of the smaller ones do? How many of you guys work for a company that's gone bankrupt and or vanished? Raise your hand. Yeah, you got it. You will. At some point, you'll take some deal to keep some, like, production, Hollywood production company's comic book arm and to do some adaptation of something or other. And they may go bankrupt while you're publishing the book. Or you may do something like Tokyo Pop, where you're doing creator-owned, but they have a part share of it. They go bankrupt and you're not going to be able to get your stuff back because they sell the rights off really cheaply to an associated company in a sort of a three-card Monty type deal, which is totally legal, just not very fair. They sell it cheaply to someone else before they go bankrupt, and then that company inherits all your stuff and you'll never get it back from that company. So two things to make sure of. The if it stops being in print clause is no longer really relevant because of digital comics. Like, when does it stop being in print? You know, it's always going to be on Comixology. It'll always be in print, you know. So rather than saying, oh, if the company goes bankrupt, I get my stuff back, it should be, if, for my creator-owned work, if my sales drop below 1,000 units a year, or $1,000, these are usual, these are common levels, the rights return to me after a full calendar year. That protects you. Bankruptcy is not a safe harbor because of the way you can trade rights cheaply. Anyway, contracts. Where have you guys fallen afoul? What's your worst contract you ever signed?
I actually had a contract come up recently that I didn't sign because I was fortunate enough to recognize it before I was about to put pen to paper. And again, my background is maybe a little different because I came up through an apprenticeship program. In that apprenticeship program, we all traded a lot of information. So I learned a lot about the business side, not just about the art side. And that's something I actually try to bestow upon my class. I teach an art class for comicsexperience.com. And at the end of the course session, I go through a lot of this stuff with my students to protect them. The contract that I didn't sign was with a fairly new publisher that came up in the last couple of years. And I saw some really weird clauses about not being able to show any of my work that I was doing for the company, not being able to really discuss the work. It was kind of an NDA, but wrapped in a work-for-hire contract.
Then they have really draconian rules, like you will forfeit this and forfeit that.
Right. So what I did was I didn't sign the contract, and I never promoted the work because that contract said I couldn't. So I never mentioned anything about that publisher, and I still won't. I had no problem taking their money. I did get paid, but I knew I was running that risk by not signing that contract. So I don't recommend you don't sign the contract, but I recommend you negotiate against the terms you don't like.
They expect you to negotiate. You know, you don't like, sometimes you're just so grateful for work, you're like, thank you, I'll sign it. Read the whole damn contract, come on, it's not that long.
Read it a few times.
Yeah, and ask for help, like ask for a friend, you know, for if you have a family friend who's a lawyer who wants to help you parse the language, that's cool. But, you know, read all of it.
Or if you even just know someone who signed a bunch of these contracts. You know, get some feedback. I at one point had a little bit of access to Harris Miller, who's a big-time comic lawyer back in the 90s. Not that he was a big-time lawyer back in the 90s, but he's still kind of big-time. But I had access to him in the 90s, so I learned a few things from just being around him for a little bit. And I kind of knew what to watch out for. But things like, you know, don't talk about this, don't show this. My attitude was, okay, I won't. And that was it. I never bothered to promote, I never discussed, and I did the work, and I knew it was a gamble. It was a gamble that at the time I was able to take financially, and it wound up paying off anyway, and I didn't let it complicate my life. Those terms were just, they were pretty good.
And it's also worth, you sign a contract, and then, you know, they start taking the piss, like, you have to do 10 revisions, you finish pages, they're approved, and then they come back and make them, you change them again and again and again. Before you take another gig with that publisher, ask them for hazard pay. Say, if you have to change things after they've been approved, you want half rate again. Because a really well-paid gig can turn into a soul-destroying, like, time of hell that breaks you if you then have to constantly do revisions due to a licensor not being able to make up their mind, or the company not having a specifically, the company itself, its editorial not being able to make up its mind. Because, you know, there are a lot of great editors out there, and that's another thing you should be thinking about, is talk to your friends in comics, find out who the good editors are, approach them. There are also a whole bunch of damn fools, and you don't want to work for a damn fool because it's a miserable experience. The other thing I'd say is remember that your editor has nothing to do with the contract process. It's completely separate divisions. Do not front to your editor about the shitty contract. Because when I was at Tokyo Pop, again, shitty contract, I was gonna sign that contract the third time, because hey, I was doing comics and money in Tokyo Pop. And I was gonna do a book with a young up-and-coming artist, and he was sent the contract, and he went off on our editor. I still have the email, I almost wanted to frame it. He went off on our editor so hardcore about the contract, personal insults and degradation and stuff like that, that we were just like, no, I'm sorry, we canceled the book. So I was like, I'm not going to work with this guy. My editor's like, I'm certainly not going to work with this guy. My editor's now in DC. This kid's never worked again. A lot of the process, like sort of the dance of formality around comics, is also like, are you socially able to function in a professional environment? It's not good enough to be a good artist or a great artist or a great writer. You have to also be able to function at least, you know, on a bare minimum civilized level with people.
I got
the first possible gig that I could have gotten, I actually said no to. I think one of the most important things to learn just on a business side or even personal is how to say no to people. Like, people don't teach you how to say no.
Yeah, there's freelancer's disease. Like, no one ever wants to say no because you might never get asked again.
Yeah,
but there's a polite way to say no. You know, I'm sorry, I'm just too booked up right now, but let's talk about it, you know, in 6 months.
Well, I think sometimes not even a polite way. I think a lot of times, when I first started in comics, most of my first gigs I got by people cold calling me in a way. Like, I built up my networking by just making good work once a month and putting it out there and self-promoting it and slowly building up my network. Most of my first gigs, people were coming to me. But you also get a lot of times people who know that you're starting and they have editorial type of instincts.
Yeah, there are publishers who specifically look for the up-and-coming people who don't know what they're worth and try to give you $25 a page to draw a book.
Yeah, basically what I was offered $75 a page from a really well-to-do, one of the first, like, viral web sensations. I'm not really sure. It was like one of those TV shows. And I had someone who was my agent get me this job. He was like, oh, I get 10%. And then when the contract started being, like, really kind of wonky, I'm like, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. You're my agent. Like, help me out here. And he actually just bounced. He said, ask somebody else. And then, like, maybe a week later, he said, make sure I still get the 10% from getting you this gig. And I was like, no, you've done nothing. Like, I would have gotten that gig just by just sitting there. Because I ended up saying no to his first gig. And everyone I asked in my social network for advice for this gave me no advice. And you just kind of realize, you really, if you don't know how to say no to the first chance that your dream's gonna come true, if you don't know how to look at something emotionless and be like, hey, this is not actually my dream come true. This is some distortion of my dream.
This is a sweatshop.
Yeah, and if you can't say no to that, then you end up in these really messed up contracts. And you'll end up getting better versions of these later on, but $75 a page for me was just like...
Is that for full color?
That was everything.
Oh, shit.
That was everything. There was a whole graphic novel, $75 a page. And I remember the thing I was a stickler on was I wanted to own the character design because that was what they did most of their merchandising on. And they're like, no. I'm like, but I drew everything. They're like, you get $75 a page. I'm like, this is not fair.
The companies that pay shit also tend to have shit contracts. It's kind of funny how it goes together. But yeah, if they're really undercutting you, the contract's not going to be a ball of roses either.
So yeah. After I turned that down, I thought I was going to quit my job, and I thought my dream was going to come true. I ended up just having to go to work the next day. I ended up crying in my studio for like an hour because I thought it was going to happen, and it didn't happen. And it maybe took me 2 years or 3 years later until I actually got my first gig.
That's another thing about comics. It's going to keep knocking you down, so if you can't get up after you're knocked down, don't do it. You know, a lot of this, again, you know, there's that base level of, like, being really talented isn't enough. You have to be able to function towards other people in at least a baseline way and be nice to them. And you also have to recover from regular crushing disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, the two basic rules about dealing with contracts are, number one, the contract terms always exist to the favor of the party that generates the contract. And I don't even care if you're Ed Brubaker or Brian Michael Bendis. Then you're going to be dealing with bigger corporations, and Disney, no matter who you are, constructs contracts that is in the favor of Disney. And the second thing, and this is tricky when you're in a situation where you turn down something and you feel bad about it, but this is a fact. No one respects you if you never say no. If you don't question a contract, no one respects you. You're a rug, and they will walk all over you, and they will smile with you every day, and they will laugh behind your back.
Remember, companies have needs. They don't have loyalties. They need you to do something. You are disposable.
If you give it away for free, no one respects you either.
Well, first of all, give nothing away for free. I know a guy, he was going to work for an independent company, and he said, oh, when they said they'll pay me on the back end. The thing about the back end is there is no back end unless there is profit. If there's no profit, there's no back end. And if you want to hear more about why you should not do your work for free, go to YouTube and type in these five words. Harlan Ellison, Pay the Writer.
Yes.
You watch that video and you will understand. You never work for free. Because your talent has a dollar value.
And if you're gonna, if you're like, I'm, so yeah, like, don't email IDW and be like, I love Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles so much, I'd do one of those variant covers for free. Well, newsflash, with the rate they gave, it's almost free. And don't do that. You're pissing in the pool for everybody else. Once you start being known as an artist who'll do anything for free at the last minute, no one will give you money. Because why should they? You're happy to give it away for free.
I also want to add one more thing from a different side of it. If you have created your own property, you have created your own story, your own characters, and it is going well, and other people are buying it, there will be publishers who will come to your door and try to offer you shitty contracts to keep your properties. And in the contracts, it will state that they will own your stuff. Don't sign that.
Yeah, the books that Vera self-published herself and did all those Kickstarters for, and then someone waddles along and goes, hey, little girl, we'll publish it for you. We'll make a nice version of it. Oh, and we get to keep it. Like, in what universe is that free? The only way you should break the don't do anything for free rule, if you're doing your own book for yourself, like, why would you do other people's work for free that you will never own? When if you want it, if you have a real itch to work for free, write your own story, illustrate your own book. Like, do something that makes up you and that you own, rather than working for a corporation for free. Now, fuckery. There's a lot of fuckery in contracts. And if you get nailed and in a bad contract or a bad situation where they don't pay you, and, you know, I work for great comic book companies. Every so often I just send the accountants a note going, hey, you know, so-and-so. June, I didn't get the March royalty. I haven't seen the March royalty check yet. Did you have a chance to send it out? I'm like, oh yeah, sorry. You know, and they're good people. They're not trying to cheat me. They're just busy, and sometimes they fall between cracks. But you know, you always have to assume at first it's ignorance rather than malice, and your life will be a lot happier. If you immediately assume people are trying to attack you or cheat you, you're going to have a hard life, and you're going to be your own worst enemy. But once you realize it really is like, they really are either broke or not going to pay you or trying to pull on and take your stuff, there are options. Colleen Duran is a wonderful, one of the foremost female artists and has a great blog and Twitter you should all follow and drops major knowledge on industry stuff every day. Hook me on to California Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts. Now, if you're working with fuckboys, excuse my French, they are likely to be in California. Like, idiots who try to steal your stuff and have little, like, pop-up-in-the-air companies that vanish because they're badly organized stuff. They all weirdly tend to cluster in California. California Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, you pay them $25 and they will represent you against those fuckboys. They have a great time taking those people down. This is, California has all sorts of weird rules about freelance compensation, and it is incredibly easy to nail somebody and drag them through the courts. So if you are in a bad situation and you have tried to talk it out and reason it out and do payment schedules and do it in a polite business-like way and have gotten nowhere, then politely and business-likely lawyer your shit up. And there's other states have volunteer lawyer for the arts organizations. So you find out what state either you are in or the person who's cheating you is in. Like, at the end of your contract will say, this contract is valid, you know, under the laws of the state of blah, New York, California, whatever. Whatever state that is, find lawyers in that state. You know, and you can, being a broke creator, there are, you know, there are entire legal organizations to help broke creators on a pro bono basis that will help you to have alternatives. So be strong. I had to do volunteer lawyers for the arts with a little company that sort of went bankrupt, didn't pay me about $5,000. They owed me on a piece of work that never saw the light of day because they went bankrupt. It was a outsourced production miniseries for the guy who directed Pirates of the Caribbean. It was his own production company, which also went bankrupt. And I got two issues in, and amusingly, it was called The Chrononauts. How many of us have work that's sitting in a drawer that never saw the light of day, by the way? Finished work.
I've written scripts that ended up not being published.
So yeah, that's the other thing. It's like, you may, like, there are, Every one of us has a project that got finished or a script that you're being paid for, often at the big two, that just sits in the flat file because they changed direction and it's not needed anymore. So, you know, don't get too excited when you sign your first big two contract because that work might not come out. You know. And again, they don't mean anything by it. It's just strategy changed, a book was canceled before it got around to your fill-in issue. You know, stuff happens. But, you know, you should know that it happens and it's happened to most of us. Paul Tobin always jokes that some of his best work is living in a flat file.
Wow.
Agents, who has an agent? Any of you have agents? Not talking to one. Our agents, like Cadence or anything like that?
I know agents, but I have never dealt with an agent. Usually, when I've dealt with contracts, I'm fortunate enough that I know enough lawyers that I will actually, and knowing a lawyer doesn't mean, hey dude, will you look at this for free? Literally, I'll say, okay, tell me what your rate is. I need you to scan over this contract. What's an hour of your time worth? And I will pay it. Because the same way you want people to respect you for your time, you have to respect other people for their time, even if they're your friends, unless they say, I'll do it for nothing. So I have had lawyers look over all of my contracts. I have had peers look over my contracts. I have emailed people who have done cartoons for Cartoon Network and popular films, because I know them. I say, hey, listen, tell me, is this kosher or not? So in lieu of agents, knowing lawyers and knowing people in the business and getting advice is a good alternative.
I see a lot of young writers especially thinking they have to have an agent as a badge of honor. It's like that makes them a real creator. No, like you don't have to collect an agent, and you shouldn't, because the agent you're going to get in the beginning isn't the agent that you want. You're going to get Ulysses' agent, who got him a shitty deal and then bounced and then wanted 10%.
Well, you know, that agent has now like kind of been blacklisted by a lot of comic people because they try to do that for a bunch of people.
Excellent.
And everyone knows who he is now, and it's just like, good for him.
There are people who try to prey on you as you come in, I'll be a film agent for you, and by the way, we also have a production company, or I'll be this agent. You know, I think some line artists get agents earlier because they work with, someone to sell their original art and market their original art, like Cadence or something like that, and that's visible, but don't expect you're going to, after your first comic script, you're going to land at CAA and, have a that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't have an agent because after that experience, I'm kind of paranoid about it. But to a certain extent, the industry has changed so much that if you're not in charge of your own marketing and branding, what you do, then an agent's not even going to help you to a certain extent. It's everyone who's a freelancer, it's so much more important nowadays to put yourself out there as you are your own product. That if you rely on someone else to do it, I personally don't trust it. I think it's smarter for you to know how to run your own business and promote yourself than to wait for someone to put your name somewhere.
Okay, here's the slide we've all been waiting for. What do you get paid in comics? And this represents a massive range. I don't know if you guys can see that down there. We all collaborated on these amount lists.
We did, and then we got some help from a secret party. Any of y'all know DC Comics Secret Six comic book? Any of y'all familiar with that? Okay, so you know that there's six people, and there's a secret person called Mockingbird, right, whose name is never revealed. Well, we had a Mockingbird who helped us with this, whose name we can't reveal, but we're thankful to Mockingbird.
Yes. These are starting rates, pretty much. The indie you'll see is a really huge range from, Chris, did you ever color a page for as little as $35 a page?
No. There were opportunities presented early on for that. I think the lowest I've ever colored in any form was about $50 a page. And that was for something that I had a stake in. So I was getting paid rate and points on the back end, which never really amounted to anything. But it was a fun project to do. And actually, what I did to compensate for the rate.
lifestyle that I was able to experiment on. And I negotiated terms where I wasn't going to get any notes unless they were storytellers. So I was able to call the shots for the most part, and I was also able to get through that book in 3 days, sometimes even a day. So at that rate, long term, it made a lot more sense to do it like that, where I was getting, you know, $50 a page for 22 pages over the course of a day or two, as opposed to working on a big two book for, you know, $100 a page or whatever it was, in the course of, you know, 5 or 10 days.
And you may wonder, like, oh, like, why would color be worth, you know, $150 a page? Okay, this is one of Chris's pages. This is from Cyclops. This is before. After. This is why. You know, look at how much of this book, how much of the effects, how much of the appeal, the look of the book. You know, that's frankly not a very interesting page. That's a gorgeous page. It's all in the color. Before we open up the questions, what's the worst rate you ever took?
Wow. For a script, $30 a page just to do dialogue. No plot, just to do dialogue.
And what's the worst you've ever been offered? Other than, like, for exposure. I live in Maine. People wow. die from exposure up here.
You
don't
know,
do anything for exposure.
Honestly, it was probably that. That rate that I just said was probably the worst. One thing about negotiating that I've done is my rate as a writer and editor varies with the client. So if I know the client has a lot of money, then I will go to the higher end because I figure that's reasonable and I will justify it. If, you know, they have a bit of a smaller budget, I find out what their budget is and I tell them what my rate is. And that's where the line is. They can afford it fine, if they can't, fine. But $30 to just do dialogue is the worst that I've ever been offered, and it's the worst that I've been.
The thing is, you offer some people a lot, you charge some people more than others, but you do the same amount of work no matter how much you're paid, don't you? You sort of, like, that's the thing.
Absolutely.
Don't cheat
right.
yourself, because you don't do less work for the cheap rates. You do the same amount of work, and when the comic book comes out, nobody knows how much you're paid, so if you're like, oh, this is a shitty rate, I'm just going to do some shitty work and slap it all together, it comes out and everyone's like, oh, this guy's shit.
Yeah,
you don't know you were paid, like, fuck all the writing.
Yeah, if that's your attitude, then you should just not even enter this business, because one thing about it is, it doesn't even matter how much work you do, your rate is as good as the last job that you did. They will look at your most recent work, and they will use that to justify what they should pay you. So, no matter what the circumstances are, once you accept it, you know, Chris right here, he runs a studio, he has fought for colorist rights, he's one of the most modest people in comics, so I'm embarrassing him a bit now, but he has fought for colorist rights for at least a decade, and he has taken extreme situation jobs, but he took them and he finished them. So if you accept the situation, you finish it, and you don't come about it. You don't ever say, well, I did this in 3 days. You don't ever say, well, I'm doing this for half of my rate, so. None of those are acceptable terms.
I've had people brag about how quickly they knocked off a job that were wanting me to hire them for other jobs. No, I'm not going to hire you if you're taking brag about how quickly you knocked off someone else's job, like how much you rushed it out the door. You know, I've had people accept a rate on a book I'm working on as an artist and then bitch about the rate. It's like, honey, you accepted it. You know, don't bitch about it after you accept it. And also always get your work in on time.
Yeah.
Well, if you're late, no one will hire you after a certain point. Editors are like dinosaurs, like elephants. They never forget. You know, I'm working with an artist now that when he just started out was doing a $10 a page gig for an indie publisher a long, like 15 years ago. And he walked off the gig after a while. He didn't turn his stuff in on time, and he walked off. He was young. He's now like Mr. Clockwork. I took this project that he and I are doing to the indie publisher, and the first thing they said was, oh, him. Yeah. He kind of like was really late on and then like flaked out on this gig.
You know,
they never forget you.
Listen,
if you are late.
Back that up. That's not just people starting out. That's hardcore professionals. I will tell you a story, and I will name names because it's history. It's a fact that other people can attest to this. Adam Hughes is one of the most known cover artists in the history of comic books. And he was the regular Wonder Woman cover artist. And due to a series of events, Mark Chiarello, the art director, gave someone else the Wonder Woman cover gig for 3 months. That happened. Matt Haley did 3 Wonder Woman covers back to back. Adam Hughes came back. Never again was he late on a cover. It doesn't matter who you are. You have to be on time. So basically, do the opposite of what I did for this panel. Basically. How I came in a few minutes late? No. Not sexy. Not good for your reputation. Always be on time. Because you will be able to use that as leverage when you negotiate a better rate. When you go to your editor, and your editor has to go to their boss, you can say, I did this monthly book, I did 12 months, I always gave in my pages on time, I maintained or excelled in quality, so that's why I'm asking you to advocate for a better rate for me.
That was great.
The worst rate I got was 90 a page, and I then read it. That was colors. I owned it. But then I renegotiated it to 120 a page, which still stinks because I had to pay the colorist out of my pocket. So it really is. No, he's getting less. He's getting 10. But it's like, a lot of times the problem I run into, because I do all the line art, is I have a really dense art style, which is like really, some pages will take me 7 days to do. And I do run into the problem where I will have to rush on the rest of the book because there's that one page and it took me so long.
There's never enough time for any book.
And
never ever.
You still get the same page rate whether you did the most beautiful one page or you did the most sparse, like nothing's on that page. And I've ended up coming up with like weird ways of like saving time, like drawing at 50% size. So that I'll do like 2 pages on one page, and like they don't know the difference. Like they still give you the two page rate. So as an artist, like, you end up having to, I actually make sure that I keep my working speed at 20 an hour. So no matter what, if it's the biggest page I have to do or the smallest page, I have to get all the pages done so I'm earning 20 an hour at the minimum for any project. And that's like how I manage my time. Because you will run into, if you're an artist, like something that you, like some pages that are just a 2-day page versus a half hour page. That's just my opinion.
And Vera, how badly did you pay yourself on the Kickstarter stuff?
I don't pay myself at all. I do want to talk about that for a second. If you are somebody who wants to create their own book, you want to use Kickstarter, you want to do some pitch pages, and you, let's say you're only a writer, you are a writer, and you want to hire an artist, do take care of your artists, do pay them. You might not be able to pay them, like, whatever they have, $700 for a cover, but, you know, try to pay them a decent indie rate at least. And if you can't pay, if you have, for example, when I do a project, I do a budget beforehand. I project how much money I might make on Kickstarter, or I see how much money I have, and I figure out what my budget is. And if, let's say, for example, in Forgotten Spirits, my series, I had, it was like $2,700 art budget. And I knew that for 22 pages of work, that's not a lot to pay an artist. So I rewrote it, and I made it 50 pages an issue. So now the artist would be getting a much more decent book, came out to 165 page. It did sacrifice sort of on my own writing, but I didn't, actually, now I don't feel that way at all. I feel I actually made the comic better, and I got to pay my artist much more, and now she's coming, you know, she came back to all 4 issues, and I actually give raises at the end of Kickstarter if I do make more. And
yeah, I bet the work came in on time because she was getting paid for it.
The work does come in on time.
You want your art to be on time? Pay your artist. I know it's like a lot of writers are like, oh, I'll just write my comic strip in the evenings after my day job, and I don't understand why my artist can't do the same thing. you know, the average comic page takes 1 to 2 days to do completely. Some take longer if they're very complicated. It's not something you can do at night, especially if you have a family and you want to see them, or, you know, occasionally you want to go out. So it's much harder for an artist to have a day job and produce a book. Whereas if you're being paid for it, you can, you know, you're much more incentivized to, like, take weekends off and sit down at your drawing table, or cut your job down, hours of your job down, or something like that. Like, paying artists is really important because art takes a long time.
I think that's really important. Like, a lot of times people, who are artists, they'll really, you know, they draw because they love it. And I actually don't draw any of my own work. Nothing. Even my most favorite ideas do not leave my body unless there's a page break somewhere. Like, I will not do, and I can say, like, I love drawing. I'm not really sure if I do. It's just what I do. But I do not sit at my table and start putting pen to paper unless there's some dollar amount coming into my yearly budget. And you have to, like, look at it like, yes, I love to draw, but I love to live a lot more. Like, I love to pay rent a lot more. And if you're sacrificing your life so you could, you know, make a mark on a piece of paper, I really don't think you really care about your art at all then, if you're doing it.
And you're not going to be in the long term, because you'll break down. You'll be like, I can't do this anymore. I'm horribly in debt. You know, I hear all these, like, young comics who are going, yeah, I'm printing my first book. I'm really, really in debt. I really have to make it work. And it's like, you're not thinking about this in any business-like sort of way. You're just doing stuff without any idea how to sell it or pitching your work or stuff like that.
Yeah, if you're going to pitch your work, I see people who are working on, like, 150-page graphic novels have no one caring if they want it. No one wants it. No one likes the art. No one likes the writer. And I tell them, like, make maybe 4 to 8 pages tops, and then see if you find the publisher.
Yeah, or look for anthologies. There are all these anthologies being kickstarted. We're going to give you a rate. Spike Trotman, Iron Circus Comics, that's a great one to hook up with. She's incredibly businesslike. She pays her people.
Yep. Yeah, but don't ever do anthologies that don't pay, ever. Yeah.
Right. They only benefit the editor.
Anthologies are, like, the worst idea ever, because most of them never pay at all.
And some never come out, but it's a great way to get your feet wet and do an your first eight pages of sequentials, your first 4 pages of sequentials. Oh, it's hard, Alex, to write a short story. Suck it up and do it.
Here's one thing about rates that's important, too, as a freelancer, and this goes back to something that a friend of mine, Phil Jimenez, said when he was interviewed in the SVA Journal, because we're both graduates of School of Visual Arts. When you get that first paycheck, remember that some of it has to go to the IRS. So when you are budgeting your income, remember that a portion of that is going to have to be paid next year in taxes, and if you don't take out any of it along the way, you are going to get nailed next year. So another good thing to have as a freelancer is a good accountant. You must have a good accountant who can be your ally.
There are always artists scratching around for, like, fast, high-paying work in March. We have time for, like, 3 questions because we talk a lot. So, line them up. There's a mic there.
You're self-publishing a story as a novel, adapted to a comic book through a publisher. How would the rights be affected? Does the copyright help with negotiations? In what state would you suggest having contracts written up?
Do contracts immediately. I mean, especially even when you're self-publishing, between you and your collaborator. It doesn't have to be a formal contract. It can just be like, hey, you own 50%, I own 50%, but you don't vest the 50% until you finish the work. That's crucial. Because I've had people not finish work. So if you've got a novel, you're doing a graphic novel version of it? It's the same thing?
No, written novel, adapted to it, comedy. Like, I'm going to self-publish this novel because I've written more than I actually have drawn. So I'm going to actually...
And you have a publisher for this?
Or I did at a point. I didn't like the fact that they wanted too much of the ownership of the characters, so I walked away from the deal. And now I want to self-publish it through Amazon to keep it, because I really enjoy the story at this point. So I'd rather go with that route. I still want these characters in my mind. It started as a comic. I just got really excited with the idea.
You're going to have a really hard time. Like, your first Kickstarter project should not be a 200-page graphic novel. No one knows who you are. You're never going to find an artist who's willing to give up a year and a half of their life to draw your pages, and you're never going to be able to raise enough money.
That's why I want to do it as a novel and as a comic. I want to take parts of it and be a smaller comic.
This is kind of a long and personal question. Hit me later, because I want to get through the other questions.
So thank you all for doing this. This has been very helpful.
Oh, you're welcome.
With doing your own stuff, specifically with collaborators and generating collaboration agreements, what does that process look like? What is the kind of discussion that goes ahead of putting putting together agreements on paper? And what's it like sort of dealing with any sort of conflict that arises between collaborators that may have kind of legal aspects?
I mean, the first thing you have to understand is that if you're the writer and an artist visualizes your characters, you do not give that artist designs in any way. This artist creates designs, that person is a co-creator. And you need to be wary of that. And if you're an artist and a writer comes to you and says, visualize my ideas, you need to be wary of that. So if you're a writer and you want to own all the rights, then you need to go to that artist with designs of your characters. If that artist agrees to be a part of your project, whomever, artist, letterer, colorist, you have to come up with some kind of wage to pay them. But if you're collaborating, whosoever creates that idea for that format, who contributes to it, they are a co-creator, and you have to be honest about it and ready for that. If you are not ready for that, write prose.
Yeah.
Honestly, if you are not ready for that, write prose.
You can write a comic book or a graphic novel and want to keep all the rights to yourself and then just hire the artist as work for hire. You're an asshole if you do that, and the word will get around, but you can do it. You just have to have a really clear agreement. I am hiring you, but then you're looking at the right-hand side of these rights. You know, like, oh, well, I own all of this, and I want to pay you $25 a page for art and $100 for the cover. No, hell no. No one's, like, the person that's going to take that is not the person you want to draw your book. So if you're going to be grabby with the rights, you have to pay them a lot more because you're paying for their time to not be on a book, which pays them.
Yeah, I mean, here's another alternative. I'm working with someone now on a project, and basically the deal is, I will pay you X so you can get done what you need to get done, and our agreement is that that will come out of your royalty. That will come out of your back end. So that way it's like, I'm giving you a little something now, because I realize it takes you time to do this. But once a clock starts ticking on your royalties, I want a compensation for that, because that artist is a co-creator. That artist is not just work for hire. So you can negotiate, but you have to be open to understanding what that person's needs are.
I think related to that is a lot of artists will be approached by writers with their like amazing idea, and they'll have a lot of money. I call those take the money and run gigs, where you get 50% up front of whatever the total is. And you just take that money, do the project, self-promote it, and then take the last 50% when you're done, and let them continue on with their dream. That's
just how it is. So one more quick question, right?
The way I work on my books is I always make sure the line artists and colorists get advances because they need to have that to feed their families and pay their rent. Because, you know, like, Walmart doesn't take exposure. You know, you can't feed your family on exposure. We're back end.
It's meaningless.
Yeah. So they all get advances up front. They come out of if we have royalties on the back end, which you probably won't have. Okay, like let me tell you about that Tall Comics dollar. If you're selling more, you know, less than 6,000 to 8,000 issues a month, there isn't going to be shit left on the back end.
Yeah, I work with a collaborator who is like my best friend from when I was 11. But when it comes to our contracts and how we work business wise, our friendship is left at.
Especially with your friends, yeah. You need contracts. Like working with your friends can like result in utter horror shows.
Your friends are the worst people to work with, so you have to be very diligent and disciplined that you treat each other as business partners, and that's all in writing, and y'all have it figured out before you've ever done anything. Before you've said any idea to each other, it's like, well, how much are you doing? How much am I doing? How are we going to split this? And have it all figured out, because that is what tears apart your friendship, and then ultimately, worse, tears apart your business.
Wait, I give 50% to my artists of 50% ownership, so we co-own it, because it's just really not fair, because the amount of art and creativity they're pouring into your project, it's not mine at the end of the day, it's ours. So yeah, you should really, like, if it's creator-owned, you should really share it with your artist. Be careful in the beginning though, especially if you're new and you find this artist you think is great and they're amazing and they haven't published that much and you're like, why is this guy like working for DC or Marvel or doing all these books? And you start working with him because he's crazy, okay? There are a lot of people who are great artists who are nuts, and you'll start working with them and you'll realize why they're not working regularly, just because they can't function, they can't collaborate, they don't get their work done on time, they're a drunk, whatever. And then you have to fire their ass. So, as I said, make sure the 50% ownership comes when the book is finished, especially if you're self-publishing.
Right. So
thank you.
Okay. One really quick one, sorry.
Thank you guys again so much for bringing up Illustration World to Comics.
You're welcome.
Coming from Illustration World, Comics World was a bit of a shock. I guess all I was looking for is maybe the silver lining in the business, you know, when you guys would be in a point where it felt as comfortable as another career
pathway. Yeah, I would say you'd have to talk with us afterwards, because that's a really big answer, but I would totally be willing to talk to you about that.
There's no silver lining.
It's exciting, but you don't make a lot of money for a long time unless you're doing mainstream DC Marvel work. I have 3 books on stands right now. Like, you know, from the looks of it, you think I'm a pretty successful creator. I make less than $24,000 a year.
It's like, what's the silver lining in coal mining?
Yeah.
What has that?
So most of us in comics have a partner, like, you know, a family member or something like that, that's like paying our rent, paying our health insurance and stuff like that, because it's really hard to make a good, honest living, especially as a writer, especially if you're doing a lot of creator-owned projects where you're in it for the longer term.
So once again, what you just heard was one of the Making Comics panels from the 2015 New York Special Edition Comic-Con, and I think it was a really informative panel. I've gone to a lot of creator workshops, and when you get the kind of insight like this where people are very willing to openly discuss the dollars and the bad deals and things to watch out for, I think it's invaluable to everybody. It's, you know, even if you're not interested in ever making a comic and you're a fan and you love to read comics, if you think that everybody lives like some sort of rock star in a palatial estate because they've had their hands in something as big as a DC or Marvel book, it's just not true. So do, you know, find out this behind-the-scenes information when you have those opportunities. And I think it was really great that ReadPop put together a track of panels that were specifically about making comics. So there is more coverage to come. Stay tuned to AmberUnmasked.com. Don't forget you could sponsor the show on the website by going to patreon.com/AmberUnmasked. Cheers.